Welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Darlitz.
Hi, listeners, and welcome back to another episode of the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. My name is Matthew Darlitz. I'm the editor-in-chief of The Neuropsychotherapist. I'm here with the managing editor, Richard Hill, and my good mate. How are you doing, Richard?
I'm doing very well here, just eager to hear the second half of our very special podcast with, guess who?
John Arden.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Now, if you want to know more about John Arden, you can go to, he's one of our resident experts. So we have a number of people who are resident experts here at the Science of Psychotherapy. And he's got a landing page and there's all this information about him. I'll leave a link in the show notes so you can go and check out John. He is a very interesting chap. Now, today, I just need to mention that we are being sponsored by the International Association of Applied Neuroscience. They've got their first International Conference of Applied Neuroscience coming up very soon, 22nd to the 24th of May. And John Arden just happens to be the keynote speaker and the presenter of the pre-workshop, the pre-conference workshop, sorry. So John will be featured larger than life at this conference. And there's a whole lot of other really great speakers there as well. We'll leave a link so you can check that out. You can check out the program. We think that you would do very well to get along to the first International Conference of Applied Neuroscience.
Yeah, it's a great one. Get along. I mean, John certainly gives it that that lovely bit of gravitas, but there's some wonderful speakers in there, so it should be a fantastic weekend. And, you know, we've been talking about it now for quite a few weeks, so I hope people have been paying a lot of attention. But if you've just been hanging off thinking, well, I wonder if I'll go... Go. Come on. Get on. Get out there and get a bit of action. And not only see the speakers, but meet your colleagues. That's what conferences are for. You meet your colleagues. You do some networking. You get some friends, which is really terrific. So can't recommend it more. But for now, we're going to go and complete our second half of the conversation with John on Seeds. Now, you can listen to these podcasts individually, separately, or the second one first and the first one second. It doesn't matter because it's going through the list of things. But if you haven't heard last week's, tune into this one now and then go back and listen to the other.
Now, Richard, we're also putting this together as a course. So if you would like to listen and see us, because the course actually has the video content, so you can see our faces as well, this is all being put together into a course, Seeds with John Arden. And for our subscribers, it's absolutely free. It's part of your subscription. If you're not a subscriber, you can still do the course. It'll be a two-hour course with a bunch of extra readings and that thrown in there as well. And it's a great way to consolidate your learning.
Yeah, brilliant. That's great. Expanding everything as best we can. So for now, I think it's time to get on with John Arden, part two of Seeds.
Here we go. So we're working backwards. We're working up the list. So diet.
What are some of the key principles?
Let's take a look at the Western diet, first of all, and then we'll work on the various details. The Western diet, actually, according to a lot of neuroscientists and people into nutritional neuroscience, actually results in the shrinking of the left hippocampus. Isn't that interesting? Mm. Well, the hippocampus turns out to be one of the most fragile areas of the brain. And in a gross measurement, you could say that up to 40% of your hippocampus shrinks with Alzheimer's disease. Alcohol shrinks the hippocampus. Looks like... the blocking of BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, is another factor that can shrink the hippocampus. And it turns out that inappropriate activation in your immune system, meaning chronic inflammation, can shrink your hippocampus too. So anything that can contribute to chronic inflammation will shrink your hippocampus. And one of the things that does that is a poor diet. So why is it then that people with a poor diet, Western diet, what is the Western diet? Basically, a lot of simple carbohydrates, a lot of processed foods, and fried foods, trans fatty acids, and also inappropriate fats. In other words, more omega-6 than omega-3 and so on. And we've been going way up on omega-6 at the expense of omega-3. I like to joke that... You know, I've eaten or tried to eat two salads a day for most of my life. I don't always do it, of course. I like to say I do it. But for the longest while, I would have the stupidest salad dressing on my salads because maybe there might be some cool spices in there. But what I meant by the stupidest salad dressings was there was not good oil in there.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So let's take a look at the most obvious factors of the Western diet. What are simple carbohydrates? They're not just sugar. Mm-hmm. It's white flour, white rice, processed foods, crackers, even though it might say, natural on it or, whole grains. You look at the box and it's really not even a good percentage. So what we could say is the less whole grain there is, in fact, we even know that the wheat that we're eating right now is not really the wheat that we used to eat when we developed agriculture in the Western world. So the whole grains are important. And if I can say a few things about this carb fad that's out there, there's this idea that all carbs are bad. Well, what do you not want to have any energy at all? And so I know there's the paleo diet and the ketone diet and the Atkins diet and all that. And sure, you can lose a lot of weight really quickly and all that. However, I do think, of course, we're eating too much especially the simple carbs and to some degree carbs in general. However, you do need carbs. You do need complex carbs, and most fruits and vegetables have carbs in them. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that a good spectrum of carbs, and I'm talking whole grains too, wild rice and barley and so on. Those are important. They're energy. Whole wheat, if it's real whole wheat, is not a bad thing. But if the more GMO-ish it is, the more stripped of many nutrients, and also more likely to have a lot of chemicals in it, because some of these GMO products actually are made so they can be resistant to Roundup, for example, these chemicals that they spray to keep the bugs off and mm-hmm. so on. So we're consuming a lot of chemicals, not even knowing we're doing it. So anyway, I went off on the carb thing. So we do want to have complex carbs. It's an important part of your diet. But the most important thing is absolutely try to minimize simple carbohydrates from your diet, meaning white flour, white rice, certainly sugar, and the poison of the Western world, which is high fructose corn syrup, which can increase the destruction of essential fatty acids in your brain, increase free radical development, and also chronic inflammation. So Matt, you had a question.
Yes. So with simple carbohydrates, these are simpler molecules which are easier to break down, so we get the energy out of it a lot faster, right? Now, there's something about us that craves that sort of thing, and correct me if I'm wrong, but we have to apply some restraint, some maybe even some prefrontal control to regulate what would be a natural desire to get hold of simple carbohydrates. Is that right?
Exactly. And previously we talked about gut bacteria, for example, and there's a thousand different types of gut bacteria. We want to have a good wide spectrum of them. And in general, we have roughly about 90% of them in these two broad categories, the Firmicutes and the Bacteroidetes. And the Firmicutes love simple carbohydrates. And what do they do? They feed on it. They make us feel like we want some more of it. And what do they do once they're fed? Well, they like to store fat cells. Mm-hmm. And they contribute to chronic inflammation. And they also contribute to gut permeability, especially if you add in lipopolysaccharide or LPS. And how do you get that? Well, you can eat a lot of saturated fat. And so just think of a hamburger. You've got simple carbohydrates, the buns, and then saturated fat, the fatty, burger, and which will contribute to the LPS. And you eat that on a regular basis, you have more gut permeability, which means essentially more chronic inflammation, dysbiosis in your gut. So your gut bacteria feeds on different types of nutrients. So what we want to do is feed the Bacteriates. So the more of the Mediterranean diet that you have, the less your gut is going to be permeable, meaning leaky, the more likely to produce this wide spectrum cornucopia of neurotransmitters, neurohormones, and all that, because, you know, the gut's second brain, so on. And and there's this information highway between your gut and your brain. And so we want to have this vibrant brain. And so we know, for example, that people that have more of a Mediterranean diet have at least a 30% reduction in depression. Big population studies have demonstrated, again, World Health Organization. So the Mediterranean diet alone is an antidepressant.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
And what's interesting is evolutionarily, so going back a ways, these things exist in us because there was a usefulness every now and again to get fast food. So, you know, the bacterioids, that was for the general food that we have. But every now and again, you get the opportunity to get quick lots of food. And so you had that other stuff. So we get it. But fast food was something that we only got on very rare occasions, not on every street corner 24 hours a day. And so that's why. Yeah. And because it's exactly as you say, it's supposed to be easy for the body to get and a quick way for us to get energy in the rare occasion that it's possible or necessary to do.
In fact, let's even take a look at what happens in the brain. I like to show these two images, two panels, a cocaine addict and a so-called normal, somebody that's not a cocaine addict. That's one panel. A person that's addicted to comfort food compared to a person that's not. And if you take a look at these two panels, these comparisons between a so-called healthy brain, and I use that word in quotes, healthy, semi, and the person that's addicted to either of those substances, cocaine or to the comfort food. What is very interesting is the area of the brain that is very involved in the process of feeling pleasure and motivation that has a lot of dopamine receptors, and there's not just one type of dopamine receptor, there's a whole bunch of different types. So take a look at two different types of dopamine receptors, D1 and D2. The D1 is the direct route to your addiction. In other words, it's directly to your basal ganglia, your caudate nucleus, and you slip right into it. Before you even know it, you're right into your old habit, whether it's Coke or comfort food. And your prefrontal cortex is going to come up with all sorts of reasons why that's a cool thing. That happens with the addiction process in either of those two areas. So what do we got to do? What we've got to do is expand the D2 receptors. The D2 receptors are the receptors that are called the indirect receptors that proliferate when you expand your number of potential positive experiences.
Okay.
And you could say that by, you know, focusing, you know, I know there's a lot of discussion about mindfulness and all that. It's almost become pop psychology, but nevertheless, it's a good thing. In other words, looking at what you were used to regard as monotony with a sense of novelty. In other words, when you're eating something that you used to not like, you're looking at all the gradients. My God, this piece of celery tastes so different from that piece of celery, rather than the D1 is, this is celery, I don't like it, I'm going to go over here. But what we're talking about with regard to diet is to get into food, to really get into, let's say, even the slow food movement that's really popular in Europe, you know. Take some time at really getting into it. It's not quantity, it's quality that we're interested in here. And so the D2 receptors proliferate with quality, and as a result of that, you're into food. So it's not like denying yourself or just say no, you know, and into these crazy diets of yes, no, yes, no. Rather, heck, I'm into food, and I love these wide spectrum of different tastes that can I can enjoy and so on. So there's an addiction process that we really ought to be taking a look at, because the proliferators of the Western diet have torqued that. you know, you take a look at all these fast food industries, like McDonald's or whatever, they have perfected the delivery system of the for the D1 receptors. You know, they want you to eat more. There was a potato chip in the United States that had the jingle, you can't just eat one. I don't know if it's in Australia.
Yeah, no, we've had the same thing.
You know, once you get it turned on, you know, it's like one beer is the next six pack. Well, one potato chip is the whole bag, you know, so to speak. Yeah. Once you get the fat and salt in there, maybe throw in a little sugar, you know, there you got McDonald's.
Yeah, you add some insulin resistance and away you go. We had a great film, Australian iconic film called The Castle. And very simple family, very simple people, and a couple of mates of mine were in it, which was really kind of fun. But he would get there at the head of the table and he would sit down and the wife would put the food on the table for him and he'd say, "Love, this is wonderful. Look at what this is. What have you done? This is wonderful." And she'd say, "It's ice cream, darling." And he'd say, "But you've done it differently." "No, I just scooped it out, love." He said, "No, you've done something different." But really, that's exactly what they were doing, certainly in a very simple Australian way, but in Europe as well. You sit there and the food sits in front of you and you go,
Yeah. And you don't scoop it down and talk so fast that, you know, it's all wolfed down before. And so we're talking about actually enjoying food. And enjoying the diet that is actually, you change your taste buds, you know, your taste capacity as you cultivate more healthy diet. So again, it's not just the Mediterranean diet. You can also be in the East and you could be into the Okinawan diet. Essentially, it's the same thing. It's the food pyramid is built on fruit and vegetables, more vegetables than fruit. And sure, you got some complex carbs in there. We don't need as much protein. And if you take a look at the blue zones, by the way, these are the areas of the world, roughly about six or so, that are identified by National Geographic as the areas of the world that have the highest number of centurions, people that live over 100. They don't have the Western diet. They move a lot. They have the seeds factors, by the way. Very important. And it turns out that they're really not eating meat as often as we like to eat. They might be more on the fish side of things. And it's not like a little bit of other kinds of meat is going to kill you. But turns out that there are some carcinogenic factors that have been looked at by, again, World Health Organization with regard to the consumption of regular red meat and so on. And any one of these farmed animals that are pumped with hormones and antibiotics and so on. I mean, that's the stuff we're consuming. I mean, those animals consumed all those antibiotics and hormones. We're eating it.
Yeah. So it's just coming back to that mostly vegetable whole food diet.
And I think that it's important for us as practitioners to do an inventory of what our clients are eating rather than, hey, you eat three balanced meals a day. They don't know what a balanced meal is. And so we've got to coach them. And with this monitor or this log that I'll send you that you put up in your bed, then the person is going to write in there what they ate. Oh, wow, you had a croissant. Well, some people think that just because it's French is cool. Well, that's just nothing but white flour. What's so cool about that?
Now we've talked about this before, where there would be some practitioners who would say, "Well, I'm not a dietitian. You know, I'm not supposed to be doing that sort of thing." But we've had this conversation before. The contemporary practitioner does have to have an idea about all of these areas.
This is the 21st century. If you want to be a healthcare professional, you've got to be into this.
Yeah.
This is part of being a healthcare professional. And sure, we're not talking about the intricacies of phospholipids and all that. If you want to get into that, you know, read my book or something like that. But still, you don't need to have that kind of level of understanding. It's just stay with the basics. Yeah. We could move to another one of the seeds factors if you like.
Yes, let's do that.
Okay. So education is really about building connectivity, and it's a building a a curiosity. You know, I'm looking to Richard, and I'm
writing it down. It's okay.
I mean, it's really absolutely important, and that's part of learning. Why do I learn? Why do you learn? Why do you learn? Because we're curious, and so we don't watch movies that we already know the ending to. We watch movies that we don't know the ending to. Hopefully, we'll learn something in the process, but that's a whole other thing. But if you're learning, what you're building is connectivity between these neurons that we have roughly about 100 billion of them. Each neuron has roughly about 10,000 connections with other neurons. The more connectivity, the more of an infrastructure of durability, we call it cognitive reserve. So I like to use my father as an example. So after he got his law degree before I was born, he kept going to college every single semester of my entire life. And then he died about 10 years ago. So he was in his early 80s when he died. But when he died, he was a graduate student in painting. However, he became a lawyer, became a judge, and so on. He just kept going to college all the time. And so that's sort of a prelude to what I'm going to say. So there's a museum in Paris called the Picasso Museum. And I've been there a couple times with him. And I said to him a couple times, in fact, I said, "Dad, you know, you don't like Picasso, do you?" And he goes, "No, I don't." I said, "But I don't get it. You keep going to the Picasso Museum. Why do you go?" And he said, "Because it's interesting." So let me describe what happens. So if anybody, the three of us or listeners might have been to the Picasso Museum, you know, it like many museums, when it's built on one painter, it's chronological. So Picasso was kind of an impressionist early on during his blue period, you know, the guy with the guitar and so on. Really, you know, quite talented guy, good draftsman and everything. And then roughly around 1914, 1915, he starts hanging around with this guy named Braque. And they start developing what is called cubism. And cubism is basically breaking things up with these lines, and you see part of the image, but the rest of it is very abstract. And so he went through that period, and then roughly into the 1930s, he started creating these faces with noses going this way and eyes over that way and all that. So anyway, my father, I'm watching him because, you know, I'm in the neuroscience and psychology. I like Picasso, by the way, but I'm in there watching him. He's going through, God, he was a good painter. He's saying out loud to me and my wife and kids. And then he gets to the Braque, the Cubist period, and he goes, "What the heck is going on here?" He's saying out loud. And then he gets to the period where the noses are sticking, and he goes, "What happened to him?" This is kindergarten art. Now, he's disturbed by that. That's my point. And so if you keep going back to what you're disturbed by, but you're curious about, then you build more connectivity. Now, we know in neuroscience that there was something called the Yerkes-Dodson curve, meaning people learn when they're a little disturbed. They're not totally in their comfort zone. They're not in the middle of a panic attack. They're a little disturbed. In other words, they're kind of going, "What the heck is that? I don't really understand that." We know now memory is more strongly related to that middle of the Yerkes-Dodson curve, or we call it the inverse U, so to speak. And what he was demonstrating was neuroplasticity there. In other words, we remember things when we're out of our comfort zone, we're moderately activated, a little disturbed. So in therapy, we could say, what Fritz Perls used to say is you need a safe emergency. Well, you need the safety of the therapeutic envelope, the attunement, the alliance, whatever you want to call it, the attachment, transference, whatever theory group you're in. Mm-hmm. We all agree, you know, the relationship's stupid. We get that. But also, you need the emergency part. And the emergency part is we're now asking them to do some things they don't feel like doing. That's what creates the change. Yeah, and that's what creates new connectivity.
We would call that controllable incongruence.
Yeah, exactly. Another wonderful way to kind of conceptualize it, because you've got the controllable part, which is this therapeutic relationship, the safety, the attunement, and all that. But the incongruence is what the heck is that? Let me see if I can bridge that gap there.
Exactly.
And that's learning. That's learning. It isn't therapy learning.
And in the curiosity approach, I'm always talking about looking for what else it could be other than what it is, which is also that constant thing that you might not even see a congruence, an incongruence, but there is one.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm always looking for.
Right. And so you and Ernie Rossi and Erickson and other people would have these pregnant sort of ideas out there. Like Erickson used to say, well, why don't you go climb, you know, Squaw Peak?
Yeah.
And he goes to climb Squaw Peak. And well, the guys go, why am I going to be doing that? Well, he had this insight that, you know, it's not all the learning and the therapy, it's what they do between therapy sessions, so to speak. But anyway, back to learning and back to the whole concept of education. You build a healthy brain. And so if you're not learning on a regular basis, you're looking in the rearview mirror. You're looking at all the stuff that have accumulated and you're really not making anything out of it in the future. Because remember, our prefrontal cortex is always looking ahead unless you are looking in the rearview mirror. And if you're not learning anything new, you're looking in the rearview mirror.
Right.
About all the terrible stuff that has happened to you and everything. We know that's a big part of post-traumatic growth.
Right.
We know that's a lot about resiliency, that you're looking ahead, you're learning new things. So education is fundamental to the stability of therapy. You're building on new insights, and it's not just one idea, it's the infrastructure over time.
So, John, one of the most fascinating aspects of this cognitive reserve that we can build up, you know, building up a more complex neural system to be resilient to, you know, some of the things that can happen to our brain as we age. I remember this study, a nun study. And I was wondering if you could just give us a brief outline of what that study was, which really showed the brilliance of how we are made in terms of being resilient to things like dementia.
Sure. And let me just say that even though you made a slip about the nurse and the nun, the nurse's study actually showed the same thing in only a more complex way. But let's take the nun study. And the nun study was a review of the cognitive and emotional capacities of this group of nuns in Minnesota. And I think the researcher was named Snowden. And so these nurses decided that they were going to will their brains to science. Okay. And so these were really interesting. Did I say nurses? I meant nuns. But these nuns were going to will their brain to science. And so they were really interesting nuns. They were involved in all sorts of things. There were teachers and, you know, and contributors to the community. And they were learning all the time and all that. And one of those nuns, I think her name was Sister Mary, was one of the brightest light bulbs there. And I think, if I get the dates right, I'm not quite sure. She might have died at age 92. I'm not sure. But anyway, she had, pretty good longevity.
Yep.
She had no signs of dementia at all during her life. Mm-hmm. And in fact, she was pretty bright up until her death. Mm-hmm. And the autopsy revealed that she had builds up of beta amyloid and tau protein, which we could say in the dementia neuroscience area are two of the hallmarks, or at least associated with Alzheimer's disease. We're not quite sure the cause and effect issue and all that. However, she had full-blown development of beta amyloid and tau protein.
Wow.
And you could say that, whoa, why would that be the case? Why didn't she have dementia-like symptoms? Well, this is the reason you brought her up. Because she had better cognitive reserve. Yeah. So she had more to work with, even though parts of her brain seemed to be, compromised. She had more connectivity because she was incredibly educated, you could say, always learning, building what we call cognitive reserve.
Well, so there's hope for me. I'm always learning.
For all of us.
Except now we have to take you out and exercise.
Oh, yes. Okay, exercise. Yes.
Okay.
Second one from the top.
Okay, so exercise, and I'm going to use World Health Organization, has identified it as probably the most important of all the seeds factors. Wow. And so what's exercise? Well, again, hunter-gatherers, we move roughly 10 miles a day. Who moves 10 miles a day anymore? And now people are saying if you don't move 10 miles a day, then you are actually compromising your brain. So in the organization I used to work in for roughly about 26 years, we did this conference in Washington, D.C. once. And the guy that spoke right before me, he was an internal medicine professor from University of British Columbia. He said that not exercising on a daily basis is worse than smoko-diabesity. If you smoke, you've got diabetes and you're obese. That's better than not exercising on a regular basis. So movement is critical for multiple factors. So let me just rattle out a few. So there are multiple metabolic factors that take place, neurogenesis factors, neuroplasticity factors, and there are a number of brain rebuilding factors. So the most popular, of course, is BDNF, or brain-derived neurotrophic factor, that's very much involved in the development of new neurons, neurogenesis, in the dentate gyrus of the hippocampus. Very important. And exercise is the best way to get that. Exercise, we're talking, you know, get your heart pumping for 30 minutes, a little sweat, and everything else. Well, there are other neurotrophic factors that are very important, GDNF and other factors. But let me include a few other rebuilding factors that are important. VEGF, which is called vascular endothelial growth factors. So think of this. You know, we've got not only just arteries going up to our brain, but also capillaries all over the place. Mm-hmm. And as we age, or if we are unhealthy, these little capillaries, these brain, these blood vessels can get stiff and rigid. Right. And when they get stiff and rigid, they can pop little aneurysms all over the place. I mean, you can get MCI, mild cognitive impairment, especially later in life. But some people during middle age get it. So vascular endothelial growth factor, VEGF, is one of the great results of aerobic exercise. Let me use another one, IGF factor, and that's insulin growth factor.
Yeah.
Insulin growth factor is really very fundamentally important for getting energy into cells, because we have a problem with the Western diet and everything else, where we've got so much glucose floating around, we've got insulin resistant receptors, right? Diabetes. You don't want to have diabetes of the brain. It's called Alzheimer's disease. So a lot of neurologists are now referring to Alzheimer's as diabetes type 3. So what's that about? It's about the brownout of the brain. Well, you can get brownout of the brain by bad diet and all that, developing insulin resistance or pre-diabetes. But also what we want to do is maximize the energy intake. How can you do that? With IGF, another of the benefits of aerobic exercise. So we know that people that exercise on a regular basis are less depressed. It is the best antidepressant that we have. Multiple studies have demonstrated that it's better than psychotherapy, better than antidepressant medication, better than psychotherapy and medication combined. Mm-hmm. And so when people say, well, I'm depressed, but I don't feel like exercising, I take them for a walk. Or I require that, in fact, that's what they're doing prior to seeing me. In fact, I try to do it before, you know, and I feel much more relaxed and more in tune.
Yeah.
To go for a walk and get outside and see the sun.
Exactly. I've already done that. See this hill? I'll just show you. I've already gone way down there. Do you see the bottom of the hill right there? Just to get my mail, I go way down there. And way up there is about 13,000 feet. Can you see that in there?
Yes.
And all these ridges over here, I have to do that daily, or at least some approximation of that. But two other things that I really want to raise here, because we haven't talked about inflammation. And I did mention that the SEEDS factors with poor quality sleep, bad diet, and now no exercise contributes to chronic inflammation. Exercise decreases chronic inflammation as measured by one of the inflammatory markers, which is called C-reactive protein, that's a protein produced by your liver. We can actually see inflammation lower with regular and daily exercise.
Mm-hmm.
So what we want to do is turn off inappropriate activation in your immune system, and exercise is one of the ways to do that. One of the most important and easiest ways to do that.
And we know inflammation is like an enormous topic. And if anything's going to kill you, it's inflammation, right?
Exactly. Chronic inflammation can dull your brain, contribute to depression, contribute to cognitive fog, make you more likely to get anxious. And the whole field of psychoneuroimmunology, wow, that's a gold mine. And we talked about that previously.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. And I do that in chapter 4 in that book.
400. Brilliant. Yeah, beautiful.
Okay, social connection, back to the top.
Okay, so we've been probably the biggest believers, the most strongest believers in good quality relationships and attachment and so on. It turns out that now there's neuroscience to support what we have been saying all along, which is really cool. So in the last, maybe 20 years or so, all these studies about insecure attachment, neglect, or child abuse have demonstrated that you can actually impair a person's brain by having bad quality or no relationships. And the areas of the brain that are impaired are critical for our ability to look at one another, read one another's mood, and so on. So what happens, interestingly, is let's take child abuse, is there's less development in the left prefrontal cortex, more development in the right prefrontal cortex, strongly associated with anxiety and depression. But if you also take a look at their brains, and I often show these in my talks, of an abused brain versus so-called normal, what not only do you see more on the right than the left, but you see less overall development in the prefrontal cortex. For neglect and abuse. And so what we also see with loneliness and with the illusion of connectivity by, thinking that you're connected with other people, you really don't have any mutually supported relationships and all that. And the capacity to feel empathy for another person is that there are areas of the brain that actually decrease their activity, like the anterior cingulate, the anterior insula, and this area that we exercise all the time as therapist types, called temporal parietal junction on the right side, which is right back here. It gives us the capacity for cognitive empathy. And also, there is a whole bunch of different types of neurons that are called spindle cells. Talking about those?
Yep.
Our friend Lou Cozzolino was the one that actually introduced me to them roughly about 15 years ago. And I've been bathing and trying to understand ever since. And it turns out that we have more spindle cells than any other species. As an example, we've got maybe about 280,000 spindle cells as an adult, and an adult ape has roughly about 7,000.
Wow. Mm. Okay.
Just incredible. And where are they located? In the areas that I mentioned before, the anterior cingulate, the insula, and so on. And more so right side than left side, by the way. So why am I going off on all these neuroscience kinds of things? Because these brain networks are hungry. And if they don't get activated, there are other parts of our body and our brain that react. And some of those factors are epigenetic and our immune system. And so what we find is, with the field of psychoneuroimmunology, is you don't have good quality social relationships, a good sense of feeling felt, and being able to generate that and be gracious towards one another and loving and so on, you don't develop those areas of the brain and you don't feel as much empathy for another person. And so this is critical to our immune system activation. So in the field of psychoneuroimmunology, we know that people that don't have good quality social relationships actually have flat immune systems. They don't work as well.
Right.
And they have more anxiety, more depression, and so on.
Okay. Now, for this, for the therapist who is looking at the social connectedness aspect here of SEEDS, and what would be the suggestions? Because you're saying that social media, which is now, you know, probably the biggest way that most people connect, isn't giving us enough or of the right thing. So what should some of the suggestions be when you need your client to get out and be more socially connected?
Well, you know, I do want to say that social media isn't bad in itself. It's the time element. Right. And, you know, checking your email, sure, why not? If you have a Facebook or, you know, WhatsApp or whatever, sure, that's fine. It's a tool as opposed to an addiction. And it turns out even some studies have demonstrated that just hearing your ding come in, there's a burst of dopamine. from your ventral tegmental area, just, oh my God, somebody texted me. It could be nothing. It could be junk mail. So we can get addicted, and the addiction is the problem, and how much time is spent. So what would be the suggestion around what to do with our clients? Well, we need to do is do a time element. I mean, and with the log that I'll send you, did you spend any time with your friends or relatives that are really capable of reciprocal relationships? I don't mean these draining relationships, you know, that is one side and you feel emotionally exhausted because the person's sucking the life out of you. That's worse. But it's mutually compatible, mutually nurturing relationships, people that care about you. And most important, that you can care about other people, because if you can express and cultivate compassion, it's an antidepressant.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking about physically going and having a coffee with someone on the phone, not leaving a Facebook post, or it seems rather strange that we have to sort of tease it out like this and make it very obvious, but it is the social media world now that we are in. A lot of people really do. They're 99% of their social contact is in a virtual world.
Exactly. We can call this junk food.
Okay.
Yeah, junk social connection. I mean, one of the things which is an interesting thought, which we haven't done any research to say it, is one of the problems, biggest problems, is the short message system and the abrupt message system. And one of the thoughts is whether the nature of the connection over social media will improve if we use longer sentences and be more fully expressive. And the same thing can be said for emails. Anyway, that's just a thought to put in there, because we're a long way from seeing whether that makes any difference. I feel it does, but we don't know yet.
Mm. Okay. Well, we've covered all of the five of the seeds, and we will have this resource for everybody to be able to download. Thank you so much, John.
Well, thank you. Great talking to you guys again.
I hope that every therapist out there now has a checklist of seeds that they can go through with their clients.
Yes, and some very good knowledge of growth factors in the brain.
Absolutely. All right.
I know, I love it. That was great. I was sitting there going, VGF, that's right. Oh, I'd forgotten about that one. See, that's the use of greater, but it's really great, John. We appreciate it very much.
Yeah, well, as usual, it's always fascinating sitting down and, well, I'm standing up at the moment because I'm trying to use a bit more energy. While I'm looking at a screen and having a chat with you, John. Thank you so much for coming on to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast.
Always delighted to spend time with you guys.
Okay, thank you.
Well, what can we say, Matt? I mean, there we are. Yeah. Just a a marvelous display of knowledge, an exhibition of understanding, and just a magnificent history of experience, not only with people and practitioners, but the brain also rolled up into a package of knowledge and really practical applications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that was great. Worth every second of the listening. I hope you were out there in listening land, in podcast land, are thinking the same things as you're finishing your walk. Or those various things that we know you're doing while you're listening to our podcast.
Absolutely.
You know, great thanks to John.
Absolutely. Look, and if you are in practice, if you're in a psychology or a psychotherapy practice, and you want to have a checklist, John has given us this checklist. You'll see it as an attachment on the landing page for this podcast or for last week's podcast. So grab that. Very useful. I know in my own practice, I would have this checklist myself. Very, very useful. And like John said, you know, this is the 21st century. As psychotherapists, as mental health and as health professionals, we do have to be au fait with all of these areas, these essential five areas of living. So make sure you get that under your belt as a professional in this area.
Yep, fantastic. But for now, I think we've talked ourselves. Well, John's talked himself. We did a lot of listening. We listened ourselves into whether a good rest. I just want to, you know, spend a little bit of time contemplating and digesting that material, and going and getting that little tool is a really great opportunity. John's gifted that to us. He's always so kind.
Fantastic.
So, I guess this is my opportunity to go off and have a brief ultradian pause.
That's right. Nurture some seeds.
and nurture some seeds. Okay. See you, Matt.
See you next time. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.